This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Time is an essential part of our day-to-day lives. It helps us know when we eat and sleep and when we need to leave the house to get to work. But it is also something much more complicated. Time is at the center of conversations about physics, philosophy, and culture. So we thought we'd take a little extra time today to talk about it. What is time? How do we perceive it, and how do we express it? And how have those perceptions and expressions changed, well, over time? We start the story with two brothers, Noah and Gabriel Harrell, both millennials and products of a digital revolution that is pushing everyone to do things more quickly. But they chose to think about time a bit differently than their peers. 4 years ago, they created the Rural Academy Theater. It's a collaboration of performers and musicians who travel the state by horse and buggy and bring theater to rural audiences. And their process is not speedy. The troupe travels at about 2.5 miles an hour, and one wrong turn could really set them back. They are in the midst of their 2015 tour. They're in Asheville this week and in the Triangle later this month. But first, they join me from partner station WCQS in Asheville. Gabriel, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having us.
And Noah, good to have you here as well.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Gabriel, tell us a bit about how you came up with this idea for this traveling theater troupe.
Well, we were both making theater in lots of places in New York and in Vermont with Bread and Puppet Theater, in Mexico, in the north of Mexico, with Teatro Indígena de la Sierra Tarahumara. It's an indigenous farmers theater. And we wanted to come back to North Carolina and make a project here.
A project in particular that would bring theater and art into small towns and communities like the town we're from, that often gets skipped over on larger touring circuits, and a way to bring theater out of the theater and art off gallery walls. And can we perform on a riverbank, in a town green? In a farm. How do we get our theater to a different audience? And we thought that a slower mode of transportation, one, would be needed, and a visible, exciting mode of transportation. And horses seem to fit that bill and bring us slowly from town to town and provide an icebreaker, I guess, a reason for people to stop and talk to us and engage us, that those people that might not necessarily come to a theater show.
What do you learn from those conversations?
So much. I mean, for instance, so much about horse travel. After one of our first shows 4 years ago, there was an older woman, I would say in her mid-80s, who after the show, we noticed she was sort of wandering around the wagon. It's dark. She was sort of looking under our wagon, and I walked up to her and asked her if she had lost something, and she turned around and told me that our brakes were hooked up incorrectly.
Wait a minute, this 80-year-old woman kind of notices at some point that your brakes are missing.
During our show, right. Our show is performed from our wagon, so our wagon doubles as our stage. So instead of watching our show, she has been sitting there watching, trying to look under our stage, under our wagon, and has done so, and now is now telling us how we're doing this incorrectly, and then she told us how to fix it.
I mean, it's kind of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, you're grateful for the advice. On the other hand, it does make you wonder if she was paying much attention to the show. I guess that's the downside.
Right.
But good thing there. And yes, yeah. I mean, the idea that this pace allows people to perceive things entirely differently. Well, tell us about the show. What do they see when they're not looking at your brakes?
Well, the show this year is, the main show is based loosely on the story of Persephone and how the seasons came to be. So it's sort of amusing on time. So the show kind of takes us through the annual cycle of the seasons and how they affect human lives.
Can you tell if there are people who come to the show, I mean, in a way, because of the way you present yourself? In other words, these are people who might not go to the theater, even if they heard about a play about Persephone and her travels. But the idea that you pulled in with horse and wagon is at least curious to them and maybe part of the reason they came to the show.
Absolutely. We travel about 15 miles a day, and if there's a 30-mile gap between hosts, we'll camp. So after lunch, bicyclers go and knock on doors of people who have suitable pasture and give them a flyer and explain to them what we're doing. And they're usually pretty skeptical, looking at a couple of dirty bikers. But then as soon as the horses pull in, you know, usually the mood changes. And for instance, one lady told Noah when he knocked on the door that she was renting the land and didn't feel comfortable. And when the horses came by about 2 hours later, she runs out in the front yard and says, wait, a young man came by here not 3 hours ago and I told him no. And then I went inside and I Googled you and I prayed about it. And Jesus told me I should do it. And we're like, great, we're sleeping here. And then she...
Thank you, Google, and thank you, Jesus.
Right, in that order, yeah. That was the order. And so then, you know, she brought out scratch biscuits and came out with her shape note hymnal from her childhood and sang us traditional Appalachian shape note music and around our campfire until midnight and then came to our show. And this is to answer your question. She would have never come to our show in a million years. She was, I guess, in her late 70s. Certainly not on the lookout for strange theater groups traveling through her area that she could go see.
But now we stop at her house every year just to say hi.
And she comes to our shows every year.
And Gabe mentioned the bicycles earlier. We travel on bicycles along with the wagon and rotate on and off the wagon, who's biking, who's riding the wagons. And the bicyclers help with traffic around the wagon, but also engage with anybody who wants to ask us questions, because the wagons need to keep moving. But the bicyclists are faster and can hand out flyers and answer questions.
I wonder to what extent the shows themselves are now shaped by this process of yours. In other words, how have you changed your idea about theater and what you present based on this method of travel and engaging your audience?
Well, definitely, we're constantly thinking about the communities that we go through and what they're thinking about what we have to talk about with these communities, what is the dialogue between us and these communities. Last year, we did a piece in response to the pro-fracking legislation that was sweeping through North Carolina, because that was a topic that we were thinking about as North Carolinians and these communities were talking about.
And there's some great stories, too. I mean, I think it came across a man in Weaverville one year who was a little skittish about you at first. Tell us that story.
It was a gentleman. It was this similar situation. We knocked on his door. He had a great piece of pasture, and we explained to him what we're doing. And he said, you know, he was a little squeamish about it. Later in the evening, I noticed him sort of standing off a distance looking at the horses grazing out in the field and us setting up our kitchen for dinner. And it looked as if he had been crying. And I started talking to him. And he said that he had been mowing this pasture for the last 30 years since his father died. And before that, the pasture had been for cows and sheep, and it had been his father's and grandfather's and great-grandfather's pasture, and he had been viewing it as a chore that he had to perform, that he had to mow, and he was looking at our horses using this pasture and realizing that what he had was valuable. This land was just as useful to us now as it was to his great-grandfather, you know, maybe 100 years before. And that if he got a cow the next day, he could just turn it out. Or if his children wanted to, or grandchildren wanted to, they could. And that was an unexpected and really wonderful thing to see somebody remembering the value of their heritage in that right. way.
Well, and that remembering and sort of bringing it forward into the present is that sort of way in which we perceive time. And you've just illustrated how powerful an impact it has on us if we just give ourselves the time to kind of, you know, do things in order or to reflect on that. And I wonder, Because it seems to me this project of yours is less about doing without technology, you use technology, and more about these perceptions of time and the way we pace ourselves. I wonder if your ideas about time, the way you engage with time, has changed as a result of your doing this.
Absolutely. I mean, the pace and the rhythms are so different than our lives outside of this tour. That it, I think there is a transition that you see happen within the group, maybe a week to a week and a half into tour. The group starts to order itself differently. The troupe starts to deal with problems and the day in a different light. That I think has something to do with the pace that we're moving at.
Well, I want to thank you both for being on the program and talking about your project, Gabriel and Noah Harrell. They are the founders of the Rural Academy Theater, a horse-pulled theater troupe that can bring performances to rural audiences throughout North Carolina. They joined us from partner station WCQS in Asheville. Noah and Gabriel, pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
You can see their show at the Wedge Brewing Company in Asheville tonight at 8 o'clock and UNC Asheville campus tomorrow at 8 and in Chapel Hill and Raleigh, Hillsboro, and Wilmington all later this month. You'll find more details at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we continue our conversation about time with a philosopher and a physicist, and we'll talk about how Einstein's theory fits into the picture. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. So imagine living in an age where the passage of time was expressed by the number of full moons, or historical dating was done by naming a king who was in power. You would think about time far differently than you do today. And for most of human history, I dare say, if folks thought about time at all, it was purely in philosophical terms. And then Einstein comes along with his theory of relativity and makes time a matter of science. So today we are talking about time, what it is, and how we perceive it and express it, and what questions it raises about who we are and how we think. Physics and philosophy are two disciplines that are both very focused on understanding time. Physics helps us explain the relationship between mass, light, gravity, and what all that can tell us about space and time. While philosophy looks at the big questions that time raises, like how does the self change over time, and what can we gain through thought experiments about time travel? We are joined by a physicist and a philosopher. Arlie Petters is a professor of math, physics, and business administration at Duke. He is one of the world's leading experts on light and how it travels through the universe. Arlie Petters, welcome back to The State of Things. Good to have you here.
Same here, Frank. I'm delighted to be here.
Also with us, Gillian Russell, a philosophy professor at UNC Chapel Hill, who currently teaches a first-year seminar on time. Gillian, welcome. Good to have you here as well.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Tell us a bit, Gillian, about early philosophical understandings of time. When philosophers first started thinking about it, who were they and what were they saying?
Well, I suppose the first person who comes to mind for me is Aristotle. So there's a section in Aristotle's Physics where he talks about the definition of time, and he considers various theories, and he rejects them all. And then he has a view about what time is, and it is, and this is a sort of a difficult thing to understand for us, I think, but it's the number of motion. And it turns out that motion, he means something a bit like change. And by number, I think he means like how to measure change.
Yeah.
And so for Aristotle, time is the way in which we measure change. It does raise this question about whether you could have time passing without any change.
Uh-huh.
And he imagines even sort of being cut off from being able to see things around you. So I suppose the contemporary way to think of that would be imagine that you're in a sensory sort of deprivation tank. So you don't get to see anything changing. And Aristotle says, but time is still passing, right? So is that time passing without change? And he says, no, because in that case, your soul is changing.
Ooh.
And so because that continues to change, time still passes.
All right. So now we've got Aristotle. Arlie, let's jump forward, do a little time travel ourselves and talk about Isaac Newton and what his theory of time was.
Well, first of all, when you look at time ticking away from me, according to Newton, it should be the same for you. If I am going very fast, it should be the same. If I go near the sun, it should be the same. And so time is absolute, and it's disconnected from space. That's a different animal, so to speak. And of course, Einstein came along and upset the entire apple cart.
Tell us what he did to us.
Well, the first thing he said is that time and space are not separate. They are part of the same entity. And time is also relative. So in other words, though our watches are synchronized, if I go very fast relative to you, my time tick is going to be different than yours. You'll see, for example, that my time expands. If I go near a strong gravitational field, there will also be a difference. So where you are in space is going to affect time.
And also, does this affect the sequencing of events? Does the way I'm traveling with respect to you, the speed at which I'm traveling, affect how I might perceive the sequence of events?
That is right. And this kind of thing, in fact, plays out in actual technology that involves very precise time measurements. And so you have to take into account if you have a body that's, say, a satellite that is going around the Earth relatively fast speed, and the way you measure time on Earth compared to on that satellite, you better get it correct.
So we couldn't have GPS if we didn't know the theory of relativity.
That is absolutely correct.
Wow. So, and by the way, this is the 100-year anniversary of the theory of relativity, right?
That's right. Einstein's theory of relativity was finalized in November of 1915. So we're having a celebration this whole year of the centennial for general relativity.
Wow. Well, this stuff has been, we've been talking about Western philosophers, but the so-called perennial philosophies have been dealing with this for a long time and have had no trouble with light not traveling through time, the oneness of all, right? The all in all, that's part of the perennial philosophies of the East, has no trouble seeing time standing still and everything being in a single moment, and that eternity is not a lot of time, it's no time at all, and the light of the world is eternal, meaning never and always. So philosophically, that hasn't been a problem at all for Eastern philosophers. And for quantum electrodynamics, for quantum physics, things being true in the present and the past and the future, that's not a problem for quantum physics either, is it, Arlie?
Yes, but a lot of times these travel back in time into the future, they happen for very short times. And of course, our question is, can we as human beings engage in that? Just continuing in the realm of speculation, there are also theories where, speaking of oneness, Einstein did a unification by first pointing out that space and time are part of the same entity. He unified that. There are some thinkers who believe that actually even the matter in our universe is unified with the space-time. They are part of the same entity. So this idea of oneness and the unification of all of physical reality, it's bouncing around, and people are trying to, of course, build scientific models out of it, meaning that we want to make predictions that are testable, at least within access to the instrumentation we can develop in the near future.
What about in terms of the self and our perceptions of the self? Again, Jillian, you talked about whether we should think of past events as real or not, present events as real or not. I mean, the idea of self and the continuity of self, given the fact that I think it's every 7 years, with the exception of neurons in our body, turns over. So 7 years ago, I was not this body. I was not me. Furthermore, 60% of me isn't even me anyway. It's all kinds of parasites and other things that are cohabitating with me. So what the heck does me mean? And if I remember myself as 7 years old, who am I talking about?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. That is a philosophical problem that people have been worrying about long before Einstein came along, although I'm sure Einstein complicates it. One way to think of the question is the person that was born and given your name, say, however many years ago, what is it that makes that the same person as the person who is sitting in this room right now or listening to this radio show? And there are some sort of first pass things you might say. So one would be, like you were suggesting, that you're made up of the same material. But you suggested the problem with that sort of view as well, which is, you know, we lose parts of our bodies, tiny parts all the time. We get haircuts. And we don't think that that means that you are, say, less yourself, that you're no longer identical with that person.
So, Arlie, this is the question I always hate to pose to scientists, but it gets to, I think, right off of what Julian was saying. I mean, the fact is it's consciousness that is what is the continuity. It's our memory. It's our memory of us. Having a continuous memory, which is all the thing that happens inside of our head. As a scientist, can you trust that what your these doctrines and these theories and discoveries are anything but a construction of the human mind for its own needs, given its own limitations?
Well, you're surely asking something that has troubled me for a very long time. Including this issue of consciousness, we would normally associate it with our head. But I think that why can't it be distributed throughout our entire body, wherever they, you know, you have neurons and electrical connections to it, nerve endings, etc. It would seem that it would be part of the entire body. Then the question becomes, this issue of consciousness, can this be connected with the fabric of physical reality? Probably at some quantum level. I do not know. I say that when I hear all the different variations on these things, what keeps me disciplined is, can one, like what Einstein did, take one of these provocative ideas and make a prediction that is testable within a reasonable amount of time?
When you were talking about personal identity, you were suggesting that it's consciousness, it's to do with our memories and things that identify us across time. But there are thought experiments in philosophy designed to test just that kind of account of personal identity. So one of the most famous ones involves teletransportation. So they're working with a theory where what's important is psychological continuity. So that might be memories, but it might also be that you intended to do a certain thing. Hmm. Say, once you got through a certain event, say you made an appointment to go to the dentist or to do various things. So sort of continuity of intentions, doing what you intended to do, but also continuity backwards, remembering what happened to you in the past. That would be sort of a psychological continuity theory of personal identity. But then it seems like you would be able to copy those features to another body. So you can imagine a kind of teletransportation machine that works like this. It scans your brain, right, and identifies all the important psychological features, your memories, and so on. And then it reconstructs them, say, in Australia. And it creates a brain that has all the memories and the intentions that you had. And just as it does this, it destroys your body in, say, North Carolina. And now you get out of the teletransportation machine in Australia, and you go around like normal, and you go to your dentist appointment, and you meet with your friends in Australia. But here's a problem for this kind of view of psychological continuity. So imagine there's a problem with the machine. Right, you get into the machine like usual, but when you press the button, nothing seems to happen. And after a few minutes, one of the technicians comes to see you and they say, oh, I'm sorry, there's been a bit of a delay, but we've copied your psychological information. We've scanned it to Australia. You're already out there walking around. There's just going to be a four-minute delay before we destroy your body here. So here's one thing about psychological states. They seem to be replicable. Right, you could have more than one person in the future having the same continuity with the person in the past. But you can't have more than one person who's identical with you.
This is why we do these thought experiments. But again, and also, let's say, Arlie, that it's not just my brain and my fingertips and my toes, but in fact, I'm connected to the whole big wide world. Here we get back to this oneness that you may be uncomfortable with. There is so much stuff, radiation passing through me every single minute of the day. To what extent am I tethered to that? It's not just that I'm passing through it, but I'm creating waves that are, in fact, a part of me, and I'm a part of it. And it's almost hard, in the same way that with those 60% of parasites who are living in me, which one is me? It's hard to define whether the cosmos is the thing or whether this particular massive consciousness is
well,
me.
Yes, I personally think of it as us being part of the entire fabric of reality. Mm-hmm. And if you go at it even at a particle level, we are, you know, fundamentally we end up being quote-unquote fluctuations within the entire fabric of space, time, and mass energy. And so to me, we are part of the same thing. Even in a more fundamental way of having, say, genetics that lead, you know, to certain similarities. I think, though, but what about for those that we may not perceive as having consciousness or being able to perceive this conversation. What about a squirrel or my little puppy?
Right.
So all of us are partaking in this reality, and we as human beings are really doing our best to grapple with, oh my goodness, I have found myself in this reality. What does it all mean? What do I take in from it? And I think this, at the end of the day, is a mystery that really tugs at us in ways that, you know, you will come up with your best model to be able to handle that, right?
And again, so let's talk about time travel then, as we try to grapple with these mysteries. That's something that, at least, I mean, I don't know, again, how long people have been speculating on the possibility of doing this, but certainly it's grabbed our imaginations, right? This possibility of time travel. But if you see us as flux, then really there's no direction. So how do you go backwards? In some ways, consciousness could, because we can think back, but the material world doesn't even think about past, present, or future. So if you're trying to materially bring me to the past, that's a non-starter. It's only true in your consciousness. It can't be true for matters. Is there something in physics that makes sense of what I just said?
Well, first, it depends on the scale at which you're looking at it. You can imagine at a quantum realm, a lot of crazy things can happen. So a particle may dip back in time for a short time. But imagine Arlie goes back in time and kills himself.
Right.
We already see the philosophical paradox. Einstein's theory, though, does allow for you to go forward in time. And so if I had a twin, and we may have heard of the twin paradox, and we're the same age, of course, and the twin goes out into outer space at high speed, turns around and return, the twin returns younger. And so that is allowed in relativity theory.
In the sense of aging at a different rate, but the fact that you might go into a future event, back to the future, and then come back into your current time frame, that's not part of the theory.
I think because it has two. There are, of course, quantitative theories that allow universes that do this. But you have too many, in my opinion, philosophical problems. And unless someone can get past these contradictions with you going back in time, I still think it will stay speculative. Perhaps we can go back in time, but just can't interfere with the past.
Yeah, I think that's important. So there are lots of different kinds of time travel stories. Time travel of the kind that we, you know, think is interesting and exciting, that it would involve people doing exciting things. And some of them seem to be inconsistent. So the kind that Ali was suggesting, that he goes back in time and kills himself, you have to ask, like, you know, you've described a certain timeline. You know, what happens at a certain point in the past? Is Ali dead or is he alive? And it seems like you want to say both, right? And since alive means not dead, you've got a contradiction there. So it's really hard to see how you've described some consistent scenario. And if it's not a consistent scenario, then it doesn't seem like it could even, you know, there's even a question about whether it could really be done. But there are consistent time travel stories. So if Ali went back and attempted to kill himself, right, and maybe he doesn't even see himself trying to kill him. You know, he's just hiding in the bushes, but then he fails. You know, there could be a story, a consistent story about what happens at each time. And it contains a causal loop in the story, but it's not like it's been an outright contradiction.
Which
so then there's a question for physics, like, is this physically possible,
right,
if it's logically possible?
Well, I wonder, though, I mean, any problem you try to solve in the past, even the grandfather paradox, okay, killing my grandfather and then I wasn't born, it doesn't have to be that dramatic. If the problem was I wanted to move the hat onto the hat rack, at the future time, if I'm in 2015 and say, oh, that hat in 2010 should have been on the hat rack, when we get up to 2015 again, that is no longer a problem, so I wouldn't want to solve it. So forget killing me. I've solved the problem. Why would I go back? Right? It hasn't even occurred to me. I feel like philosophically and logically, you can't possibly do it.
That makes people tempted to accept some sort of idea about hypertime, where there's actually a second temporal dimension. So there is the sense of what happened first time around, but then there's the next time, what happened the next time around, and that you actually, in some sense, preserve both. That's absolutely wild. Like, I don't know if there's any reason to think that that's the way things really are, but it would allow you to make sense of the story.
Well, Arlie, that, I mean, as I understand string theory, and my understanding is very narrow, that those multiple possibilities is kind of what you're looking at.
So, well, first let me say that mathematicians have developed already a geometry that deals with many dimensions of time. And so there is, in a sense, a mathematical infrastructure there. The problem is the equations or the physical laws that we have, all of them have one dimension of time. No one knows, maybe one of your listeners will figure this out, no one knows how to write down a consistent theory using two dimensions of time.
But if we did, then some of these paradoxes and riddles could be answered.
And a lot of other bizarre things. If you think Einstein, you know, is bizarre, then we'll go to the nth degree.
We are out of time, sadly, but I want to thank you both very, very much. Lively discussion. Thoroughly enjoyed it, and I won't be able to sleep tonight. Arlie Petters, Professor of Mathematics, Physics, and Business Administration at Duke. Arlie, thank you so much. Good to see you again.
Thank you, Frank.
And Gillian Russell is a philosophy professor at UNC Chapel Hill, currently teaching a first-year seminar on time. Gillian, what a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You can learn more about Einstein's theory of relativity and celebrate its centennial at a seminar at Duke next Friday, October 16th, that celebrates the centennial of Einstein's general theory of relativity, room 128, the physics building at 4:30 p.m. You can find that on our website at stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we're going to go forward and backward in time as we explore representations of time travel in fiction. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. If you could get into a time machine and travel to any point in the past or future, where would you go? And what would you do when you got there? Now, these are the kind of questions that have lit up our imaginations for decades and are the subject of a wide range of TV shows, movies, and literature, from H.G. Wells' 1895 novel, The Time Machine, to more recent films like The Butterfly Effect and the infamous 1985 film Back to the Future. Today we're talking about time, looking at how it bends, morphs, and changes, and also how it changes us and how we think about the world. David Wittenberg is a philosopher and comparative literature scholar who spent quite a bit of time pondering time travel narratives. He's looked at how time travel fiction has changed over the years and how it's influenced by the popularization of science. He's the author of the book Time Travel, The Popular Philosophy of Narrative, and he joins me now. David Wittenberg, welcome to The State of Things.
Hello. I'm delighted to be here.
It's good to have you here. The central premise of your book is that time travel fiction is what you call a narrative laboratory. Tell us more about that.
That's right. It starts in the 19th century as a storytelling technique for utopian writers who need a method of realistically getting their characters to the future. But after the 1920s and 1930s, when Einstein's theory of relativity really hits the popular imagination and writers start using possibilities that it opens up, then time travel narratives become what Gillian was calling a thought experiment. And all sorts of possible scenarios that hadn't existed before Einstein enter the literature, and some of the ones that we're very familiar with today are relatively late inventions of the 1930s and 40s, the time travel paradox, the grandfather paradox. It becomes a literature about psychology and about history, about meeting yourself, about changing the past, about determining your own identity, all the kinds of things that you started to talk about with Gillian and Arlie in the first segment.
And it's interesting that this would really develop in the 19th century because it also reflects anxieties about where we're headed. Industrialism has raised serious questions about the future of the planet. It opened up new possibilities about what consciousness meant. I mean, all of those things are happening, and this fiction is in a sense created to carry those big kind of questions and anxieties. Am I right?
That's right. You know, in the 19th century, it really is a technique for political literature, political storytelling. Utopian literature uses time travel to project realistic futures, largely because of the pressures of Darwin's theory of evolution. People feel that when they're writing political theory at that point in history, they'd better do it realistically. They better evolve the future out of present conditions. And time travel, especially long sleep narratives, provide a means to do that. when you get time travel paradox stories and multiple universe stories and those kind of stories that we're more familiar with today later on, a lot of those political and social issues go beneath the surface and they're no longer that's in the center of the narrative, which in some ways is unfortunate, but it allows writers to indulge other kinds of philosophical and psychological issues. And you can still see remnants of those social and political issues in a story like Back to the Future, which, you know, one would have to say relatively lightweight in political terms. But nonetheless, there is a theme about culture and about cultural difference and generational difference and so on running all the way through that film and the whole trilogy, in fact.
Although, but you talk about in your book the way, in a sense, the film becomes a kind of meta-narrative and a way to gloss over the more important political points. And you know, nostalgia becomes kind of a palliative in this as well as it was in the 1980s. This was the right. I mean, this was the dope peddled by the Reagan administration. Don't watch what we're doing. Take a look at the 1950s. Remember then? So I mean,
yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, and so it's fascinating the way it works. In fact, I want to hear you talk more about it. But just in case we don't remember that 1985 film. By the way, 30th anniversary of that film, the 100th anniversary of the general theory of relativity. Coincidence? Anyway, here's the clip.
Mom, is that you?
You're there now. Just relax. You've been asleep for almost 9 hours now.
Had a horrible nightmare. Dreamed that I went back in time. It was terrible.
Well, safe and sound now, back in good old 1955.
You're my mom.
My name is Lorraine. Lorraine Baines? Yeah.
But you're so thin.
Just relax, Calvin. You've got a big bruise on your head.
Where are my pants?
Over there. On my hope chest. I've never seen purple underwear before, Calvin.
Calvin, why do you keep calling me Calvin?
Well, that is your name, isn't it? Calvin Klein? It's written all over your underwear.
Ah.
Oh, I guess they call you Cal, huh?
No, actually, people call me Marty.
David Wittenberg, what kind of things does that clip bring up for you?
Well, you know, clearly this clip is about the Oedipus complex. And you don't have to be a psychoanalytically inclined literary critic or cultural critic to know what the Oedipus complex is. Anyone in the audience understands that Marty is encountering his mother, who doesn't realize that this is her future son. And he's attracted to her, right? he says, you're so thin. And of course, she's flirting with him. And, you know, it's a relatively weighty and complex kind of psychological problem that you're encountering in the film here. So if there is a suppression or a delusion of political and social issues in the film, some of the complexity that's lost on the political and social register is then substituted on the psychological and narrative register. We have a fairly complicated kind of narrative problem here and a fairly complicated psychological problem. And the audience of a film like this is perfectly capable of working through that kind of problem. And the film, you know, there's very interesting and some uninteresting things in this film, but the way it works through the Oedipus complex and the way it works through the attraction of Marty to his mother and the problem that causes is quite interesting. It's pretty complicated and rich.
But it gets solved pretty easily. I mean, there's a kind of evasion of the central complex in the way it gets sort of glossed over and solved, right?
That's right. I mean, it's not surprising because we're dealing with mainstream popular culture here, and there's not going to be a very in-depth working through of psychological anxieties, let's say. The problems that are raised are going to be solved on the level of plot, through plot twists. And
right.
If you remember, the plot twist here is that Marty's father has a fight with Biff, who's the sort of perennial villain of the series, and that fight allows him to hook back up with Lorraine and become a proper father, and then we're back in the future and everything's solved. And time travel stories do this very often. They solve problems on the level of plot. They fix the plot when it's gone awry. And they conserve the various kinds of narrative, but also political and ideological strands that have been kind of let loose by the paradox.
Yeah, and
tie them back together.
Tie them back together. Does this represent a fairly radical difference from or extreme difference from some of that early literature in terms of the way they dealt with and were focused on some of the political and social issues that they were trying in whatever utopian vision they might have had, problems they were trying to solve?
Well, there's some difference, but I think in a way that this tendency to close narratives off, to tie up loose ends and so on, is not just a part of time travel narratives. Very clearly, it's a part of all sorts of narratives that we tell. We like endings, and we like generic conclusions, and we like coherence and integrity in a narrative. And this has been true throughout the history of narrative and may simply, in fact, be wired into our sense of what narratives are and how we tell stories about ourselves. So that's one of the senses in which time travel stories, time travel narratives, become themselves a kind of thought experiment about how we tell stories or about how narratives are constructed. And that's one of the main things I'm interested in the book.
Another of the paradoxes that we sort of deal with and that film has dealt with anyway in time travel, I think we have an example from Star Trek, The Next Generation. The episode is Yesterday's Enterprise. Maybe you should set up the clip for us.
Yeah, this is a time travel narrative of the sort that Julian referred to as inconsistent or illogical. Right here, the Enterprise comes upon a rift in space. This happens quite often, obviously, and out of the rift comes a past version of the Enterprise. And when this happens, suddenly there's a special effect, a kind of saturation on the screen, and everything changes because there's been this intervention in the past or this rift between the past and present. Now suddenly the Enterprise is a warship instead of an exploration ship, and there's a war with the Klingons who are supposed to be at peace. Everything's gone wrong. Everything's all messed up. And now we have a conversation between Picard, who doesn't realize, of course, that he's in an altered history, and the character Guinan, who's a rather interesting character who somehow has an inkling or realizes that this history they're now in is wrong. And so we have this conversation between them.
Guinan?
We need to talk. Somehow this is all wrong. This is not the way it's supposed to be.
But you must have some idea how things have changed.
I look at things, I look at people, and they just don't feel right.
What things? What people?
You. Your uniform. The bridge.
What's the matter with the bridge?
It's not right.
It's the same bridge. Nothing has changed.
I know that. I also know it's wrong.
What else?
Families. There should be children on the ship.
What? Children on the Enterprise? Guinan, we're at war.
No, we're not. At least we're not supposed to be. This is not a ship of war. This is a ship of peace.
What you're suggesting?
I'm not suggesting. That ship from the past is not supposed to be here. It's got to go back.
That's a clip from Star Trek The Next Generation, the episode Yesterday's Enterprise. I'm talking with scholar David Wittenberg, who authored the book Time Travel, The Popular Philosophy of Narrative. And David, you argue in the book that the scene brings up a range of ideological and political issues. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the viewers understand, like Guinan understands, that something's gone wrong, and this time travel paradox that they've encountered has set history on the wrong path. So the timeline we are now watching, and you can hear it in the conversation, is the wrong one. Why certain timelines should be right or wrong in a narrative is a rather interesting question. But at the very least, we know that the Enterprise is not the same Enterprise that we've seen in all the other episodes we've watched, and this is not the right Picard. And in fact, there's a character who was killed off in an earlier episode, Tasha Yar, who suddenly reappeared in this episode. She wasn't killed off. So all of that has to be fixed. And as viewers on TV, we understand that it all has to be fixed. But what has to be fixed is not just the narrative, not just the plot line, but also the ideological and ethical and even political implications of the Enterprise, the Federation, the culture, the future culture that we're watching. So Guinan, who is our proxy within the narrative, the character who, like us, like the viewer, knows that this is not the right story, this is not the way the TV show is supposed to look, steps in here and intervenes and eventually persuades Picard to send that other wrong ship back and fix the timeline. And everything comes out, of course, by the end of the hour, the way it's supposed to, when we're back in the right timeline, we're back in the right history. But there's a, you know, you see here how the level of narrative and the level of politics and the level of industrial television production and consumption and the level of cultural capital and knowledge and the viewer's savvy and all these levels interact to make certain stories appear correct and certain stories incorrect or certain stories proper or improper. So there's actually quite a lot of material kind of wending its way through this scene, quite a lot at stake.
Yeah.
When the narrative repairs itself.
Well, and this brings us to another point that you make in the book, which is that we consider science fiction, time travel science fiction, a kind of subgenre. But you argue that no, that narrative itself is time travel, and that this is that in effect, narrative is a subgenre of time travel.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not the only one to suggest that kind of thing, but I think that's right in a certain sense. Whether it's right or wrong, it's an interesting way to look at stories, and it's an interesting way to think about time travel, again, as a kind of thought experiment. Here, not a thought experiment in physics or mathematics, but rather a thought experiment in the criteria or the structures we need in place in order for narratives to work properly, in order for our stories to make sense to us or to seem right.
And point,
you can see that in the episode.
Right. And point of view then is critical. So it's critical to the physicist whether you're on the beam of light and how time and space look to you if you're riding a beam of light versus standing on Earth versus on a satellite moving at a different rate of speed. So the physicist is very much aware that point of view is everything. And I think what you bring our attention to is that for the reader and for the viewer, point of view is everything. And so for the creator, the movie maker and the novelist, taking that into account is critical to constructing the narrative.
That's right. And of course, physicists and mathematicians have fairly strict rules about which points of view are allowed or not allowed, physical or unphysical. Time travel writers and filmmakers have no such qualm. You know, you can make any viewpoint you like. In the episode we just listened to, we're not supposed to be able to see that alternate, inconsistent timeline, but we see it perfectly fine. It's not a problem for us as viewers or as filmmakers using a camera to show it. So time travel stories allow us to speculate on situations or scenarios that wouldn't be possible to speculate on in physics and mathematics. And in fact, even philosophers who come up with time travel scenarios as thought experiments do this kind of thing all the time. What would happen if? It's a counterfactual situation. It's described by philosophers. What would happen if the history didn't look this way but looked this way instead? And that's also obviously a way of understanding what has happened and what is the case in the real world we live in.
That is philosopher and comparative literature scholar David Wittenberg, author of the book Time Travel, The Popular Philosophy of Narrative. David, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
You can find out more about the book and everything we talked about today at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton, and Andrew Tai. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.